Hi, and welcome to the show. I'm Suzanne.
And I'm Emily. Hello and welcome. We're glad you're here with us exploring the spooky side of the art world. Thanks for listening.
We've covered the possibility of ancient saltwater or freshwater crocodiles from the Cretaceous period somehow surviving or maybe having a relative crocodile down the road. Many, many years later, this long-lost grand croc is a whopper of a leap beyond credibility, but such a crocodile could have been the dragon who St. George took down in the legendary story. With that huge leap of imagination behind us, we wanted to finish the series with some further readings about dragons, St. George, and a very special illuminated letter all about St. George. Before we get started, here's how Faber-Castell, who makes pencils I use in my sketchbook and on larger drawings, they also make colored pencils, watercolor markers, and fountain pens. They're located in Stein, Germany. Anyway, this is how they explain illumination. Quote, "The term illuminated means to be filled with light. The term illuminated lettering was originally used to describe the gold leaf embellishments in medieval manuscripts, which caused the pages to reflect light and appear to glow. Illumination also refers to the illustrations and decorations drawn around the letters. For many in the Middle Ages, most of whom were illiterate, the illuminations brought the stories to life. In modern interpretations, artists use illuminated lettering as an opportunity to showcase their illustrative talents." The following is read from Illuminations, A Lesson in the Art of Illuminated Letters by Amy E. Bruce, found on the West Contra Costa Unified School District site, wddusd.net, in Richmond, California. Quote, "When were they made? The Egyptians were the first culture known to document events by use of illuminated manuscripts, one of the most famous being the Book of the Dead, that dates back to 1310 BC and carried on the tradition for hundreds of years into medieval Europe during the Middle Ages. By the 7th century, illuminations became a highly respected art form. At this time, some of the most beautiful and famous illuminations were now being created in Ireland and England. Who created them? There were three people involved in the creation of illuminations. The parchmenter, who prepared the drawing and writing surface. The scribe, who copied information onto each page. The illuminator, who actually created the illuminated letters and other decorations on each page. During the Middle Ages, most of this kind of work was done in monasteries, so all of these jobs were performed by monks. He would first make a rough sketch, then outline that with a pen. The gold leaf would go on first, followed by all the other colors made from ground-up stones and plants. So keep all this illumination refresher stuff in mind as we run through some of the last pieces of our research, because we'll get to it in Gardner's Art Through the Ages later on.
So this is from a Fantasy Encyclopedia, A Guide to Fabulous Beasts and Magical Beings from Elves and Dragons to Vampires and Wizards. And it's by Judy Allen with a foreword by Jonathan Stroud. It was published in 2005. So dragons in the West. Western dragons are usually dangerous. Some are so evil they are said to be the devil himself. Like Eastern dragons, they are associated with water, but they are more likely to bring destructive floods than plant nourishing showers. Unlike Eastern dragons, they are usually hunted and slain. Dragon slayers. Saint Michael fought the devil dragon and threw himself out of heaven, but the most famous dragon slayer is Saint George. Legend tells us that in his time, around 2,000 years ago, there was a terrible dragon who lived in a lake and demanded human sacrifices. St. George happened to pass by just as the king's daughter had been tied up and left for the dragon to eat. In some tellings, he killed the dragon at once. In others, he wounded it, and he and the princess tied it with her sash and led it to the heart of the kingdom to kill it in front of the people. Traditionally, the Western dragon is killed with an iron lance. The first iron known to humans is likely to have been found in meteorites. Because meteorites fall to Earth from the sky, it was believed that it had come from heaven and therefore had the power to destroy evil. Good dragons. However, not all Western dragons are bad. When Uther Pendragon, father of King Arthur, was born, two golden dragons appeared in the sky to herald the birth of a chieftain, and dragon images appeared on shields and banners for battles. There are even stories of dragons kept as pets, and also of dragons who help humans, such as Falcor the Luck Dragon, in the Neverending Story.
Falcor is awesome. I will say that for sure. And I'm super cute. And one other thing, I believe it was Mary Stuart wrote a few novels about the Arthurian legend. And the Crystal Cave is one of those. The Hollow Hills is Welsh and English. And basically the story of Merlin and Arthur. In it, there's a story of a dragon slumbering in a cavern under a hill. And also tying into Arthurian legend with these, or, you know, as you just said, with the golden dragons heralding the birth of a leader. The Crystal Cave was written in 1970 by Mary Stuart. It just shows how it's made it into popular culture, that this was a fantasy book and she was again talking about dragons. Sorry, that, I don't know if that's useful or not.
I think it is.
It's a really good book if you ever wanted to read them, that series. It's like...
I've read the first one, but I haven't read the other two.
Okay, yeah, just if you're ever in a, you know, good medieval mood. I'm going to read from a special issue of Life magazine on miracles, the presence of God in our lives. In the section, The Miracles of the Saints, on page 81, they talk about George, or Saint George. Most of the saints in this chapter are here for a very good reason. They are like Francis or Catherine on these two pages, among the best expressions of humanity that our meager human condition can offer. A couple of them, however, we freely admit are here because anyone might ask, hey, what about... dot, dot, dot. They illustrate the depth and breadth of our belief in miracles, and so the validity of their inclusion in a book such as this is arguable. But the counterargument to whether that space could be better used on a more illustrious saint can, and probably should, be made as well. And yet Joseph of Cupertino, whom you will meet on the very next page, could fly, and George killed a dragon. Fun stuff. We're keeping them in. Okay. George was a different kind of saint for reasons other than his dragon killing. Seen above in a 19th century painting by Eugene Delacroix. For one thing, he was born circa 280 to a Greek Christian noble family in Cappadocia, and his fame transcends even Christendom. He is one of the precious few official saints with a strong historical personality in Islam as well. He apparently had lost both his parents by the time he was an adolescent. His family's heritage was military, and George became an officer in the Roman army, ascending to be the emperor's aide. After centuries of doubt to whether Saint George, who is the patron saint of England, ever really walked the earth, his historic existence has been generally conceded. But we should maybe leave the factual record at what we have just written. The legend is more vibrant. In the year 302, the emperor Diocletian ordered that all Christian soldiers be arrested. With George, this presented a problem. Diocletian valued him greatly and tried vigorously to convert him. But George was resolute in his faith and vowed allegiance to Jesus Christ, refuting all Roman gods. He was tortured, then martyred. Oh yes, he had slain a dragon earlier when proving himself to the emperor. So that's what life says about miracles and how St. George was involved. This book is Gardner's Art Through the Ages, 10th edition. So we're reading in the section on illumination on page 409. That same vocabulary, richly applied and gracefully modulated, appears in what surely must be one of the masterpieces of medieval art, a manuscript illuminated in St. Bernard's great abbey. Citeaux and its sister abbey, Clairvaux, where St. Bernard was abbot, produced magnificent illuminated manuscripts throughout the 12th century. One of the most remarkable was Gregory's Moralia in Job, painted before 1111, a splendid example of Cistercian illumination. The historical initial from this manuscript represents St. George, his squire, and the roaring dragons intricately composed to make the letter R. St. George. A slender, regal figure raises his shield and sword against the dragons, distinguished representations of the age-old animal style so often encountered, while the squire, crouching beneath St. George, runs a lance through one of the monsters. An image of status, the greater and the lesser dragons, correspond to the lord and his man. The ornamented initial goes back to the Hiberno-Saxon 8th century. The inclusion of a narrative within the initial is a practice that would have an important future in Gothic illumination. The banding of the torso, the fold partitions, especially evident in the skirts of the servant and the dovetail folds, all part of the Romanesque manner, are done here with the skill of a master who deftly avoids the stiffness and angularity that result from less skillful management of the vocabulary. Instead, this artist makes a virtue of stylistic necessity. The partitioning accentuates the verticality and elegance of the figure of St. George and the thrusting action of his servant. The flowing sleeves add a spirited flourish to St. George's gesture. The knight, handsomely garbed, cavalierly wears no armor and aims a single stroke with proud disdain. This miniature may be a reliable picture of the costume of a medieval baron and of the air of a nonchalant gallantry he cultivated. We have noted the institution of knighthood as associated with the crusading barons. Knighthood was a kind of consecration of the profession of arms in the service of Christendom. The baron, leaving his lands to journey to far places to campaign against the infidel, becomes the knight-errant, roving in search of adventure as well as for the sake of the cross. The knight-errant sought also to protect the weak and the oppressed. Inevitably, he served the defender and lover of a lady in distress, whose champion he became. The image in the legend of St. George, patron saint of soldiers, is that of the Christian knight, who not only rescues the beautiful maiden menaced by the dragon, but also appears to the crusaders at the wall of Jerusalem and delivers the city into their hands. His figure here in the Cistercian manuscript produced in St. Bernard's Milius, telling historical evidence of the value set upon knighthood in the age of the Romanesque. I think I'm going to leave it there. That was page 410 through 411.
With that last episode, we say farewell to the dragon, princess, and St. George, and to the amazing art we've seen during this research. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram to see related art posts to the episodes that are coming out. We'll be posting the illuminated letter that we talked about soon. You can follow the Whispering Gallery podcast on Apple Podcasts to be sure you catch each of our episodes. We publish every 2 to 3 weeks and are an independent show. We are also on Patreon, which helps fund our research library and would allow us to offer the podcast on Google Play, for starters. We just purchased Kraken, the curious, exciting, and slightly disturbing science of squid by Wendy Williams. And yes, we're covering some watery art next time. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today as we waded through some pretty heavy-duty research. Take care. We can't wait to share the next episode. Talk to you again soon. The music featured in this episode, Chopin Waltzes Valse No. 10 in B minor, Opus 49 No. 2, performed by Ronnie Munro and his orchestra on 78 RPM, London Music Library.